For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you, Tigan, for the invitation to give the Dharma talk today. What I'm talking about today is Bodhidharma's outline of practice. So Bodhidharma is a historical figure. Those of you online can see his image on this book. That is believed to have come to China in 527 CE. He was an Indian monk who brought a certain style or flavor of Buddhist practice to China. He's believed to be the 28th patriarch of Buddhist lineage after the historical Buddha Shakyamuni. He's also believed to be the first patriarch of Zen or Chan. Zen Buddhism being the style of Buddhism we practice here at Ancient Dragon. There are a number of stories and ideas surrounding Bodhidharma. One of them is that he was a manifestation of Avalokiteshvara. So Avalokiteshvara is an embodiment of the practice of compassion, oftentimes appearing as a female, but Bodhidharma appeared as a male and was believed to also be a manifestation of this practice of compassion. He's known by different names in different Asian countries. In China, he's known as Dhammo. In Japan, he's known as Daruma. So I bring this up because if you practice Zen Buddhism long enough, sooner or later, you're going to come across this image of Bodhidharma, which looks very different than the images we usually see when we see Buddhist iconography. He has long hair, bugged out eyes, so on and so forth. But sir, you're going to hear little references to him, or you'll see images of him, and his being kind of seeps into our practice. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about one of the first teachings he gave. He did not bring Buddhism to China. Buddhism was already being practiced in China during the Han Dynasty, which was 206 BC to 220 CE. And then saying that he came to China in 527 CE, there are people give it 100 years earlier than that, 100 years after than that. It depends on the historian and who you're looking at that's talking about him. But I'll use the 527 CE because that's what, in my lifetime, has been the most common number. You'll hear different things and teachings about him. Dogen referenced Bodhidharma's coming to the West. When you hear this reference to Bodhidharma coming to the West, it's not to America, it's not to England, but it's to China from India. You'll hear the story of Dhammo and Emperor Wu, or Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu, when he first got to China, the interaction and the dialogue that he had with Emperor Wu, which is actually a teaching on emptiness, which I'm not going to go into right now because that's a whole nother Dharma talk. You'll hear a story of his wall gazing for 9 years. So it's known that when he came to China and after his engagement with Emperor Wu, which didn't go very well, according to our normal ideas of what goes well, he went into a cave near the Shaolin Temple and sat in meditation for 9 years. The legend says, with no food, no water, and no sleep. And that, again, is another story around the legend of Bodhidharma. There's also the story of his first disciple, Hui Ke, sacrificing his arm in order to be accepted as a student of Bodhidharma. So these are all different stories that you'll hear over the course of time if you practice Zen Buddhism. But bottom line is he's a mysterious and mythical figure. He may or may not have existed. There's really no proof that he existed. There's very little written down about him, and there's very little written down by him. This outline of practice that I'm talking about today is attributed to be the first sermon or teaching that he gave. And the spin book that I'm holding right now are all his teachings. That's it. His primary idea that he was trying to bring to people was to experience the Dharma. He believed that the Dharma, which sometimes is translated as teachings, sometimes is translated as truth, sometimes is translated as reality, is available to all of us to know for ourselves experientially through our practice. In order to do that, his outline of practice says there are many roads that lead to this path, but essentially there are two primary vehicles, reason and practice. So a lot of roads lead to this path, but we have two primary ones that we utilize to practice the Dharma. The first one, reason, and reason in this context being more so just sound judgment and good sense, as opposed to analytical, looking at a bunch of writing and deducting things from it. Not necessarily having the analytical mind work too much, but just through practice, having sound judgment and good sense. And the sound judgment and good sense comes to be realized through actual practice. And what is realized is that this essence of the teaching is that all living things share the same true nature. That essentially all of us, even though we have what's called different Dharma positions, we all hold different names, we have different experiences of our lives, and all the living things around us do. Underneath all of that, we all share the same true nature, nonetheless. So essentially, there is not an us and them, a me and the other. And thinking that there is duality. So when we think of us and them, me and other, up and down, this in itself is delusion. Because underneath everything, we share the same essence. Believing there isn't a duality, believing that we share the same essence, is becoming aware of the truth of reality, the truth of our existence. So Bodhidharma says, people who believe this truth are people who meditate on walls. Basically, another kind of interesting way to say they meditate. And through this meditation or stillness, they are even unmoved by scriptures. So through this practice of stillness, even reading sutras and so on doesn't disrupt their stillness, doesn't disrupt the meditation, the ideas that are necessarily being introduced. In his words exactly, without moving, without effort, they enter, we say, by reason or sound judgment. They enter practice. And then moving on to the practice side of these two gates. The practice side has four inclusive practices that correlate also to the Four Noble Truths. So I'll hit on the Four Noble Truths as we go through this. But the Four Noble Truths are some of the first teachings that the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, taught in order to teach the people who were following him about his awakening. The first inclusive practice for entering the path is suffering and justice. And basically, we all know that one. That's when you experience that life isn't fair. Now, Bodhidharma ties this to karma. And karma is a concept, and again, these are all things you could go deeper with, but to try and cover this in this Dharma talk without getting too into karma, it's accepting that whatever you're suffering now may relate to some bad actions that were done at another time. And it's not necessarily that whatever I, Paula, am suffering now is that I, Paula, in some other life did. If we accept the lack of duality of things, if we accept the fact that underneath all of this, we are essentially the same, A part of each of us in the present has some aspect of past misdeeds that can activate in our present selves. Bodhidharma says, the sutras say, the teachings say of other great masters that when you meet with adversity, don't be upset because it makes sense. Just makes sense. So life isn't fair. When we could understand that life isn't fair, we're understanding there is a certain inevitability in that suffering. And in Western parlance, we usually say, why me, why me, why me? And the answer to that then would be, why not? Why not? Right? So according to Bodhidharma, this idea is in harmony with reason. And then this first inclusive practice correlates to the first noble truth of life is suffering. The second inclusive practice for entering the path is adapting to conditions. So we all know that good and bad fortune all depend on conditions that are ultimately beyond our control. So in the West, you know, we believe if we work hard, we'll gain certain things. But we do know that even if we gain certain things through hard work, there are conditions in the world that could change, that could completely eliminate everything that we have, regardless of how hard we work. Here in the United States, that's not as real for us. But historically, in most of the countries around the world, and for many of our ancestors, they know that to be true. When conditions change, whatever is happening ends. So if you have something good happening, conditions change, it ends. When you have something bad happening, when conditions change, it ends. So impermanence, or wanting something to remain the same, is completely unrealistic. And we know this from our own experience. Bodhidharma's exact words to this is, those who remain unmoved by the wind of joy silently follow the path. And this correlates to the second noble truth that the Buddha taught, which is desire is the cause of all suffering, our need to want a set outcome. The third inclusive practice for entering the path is seeking nothing. Those of us who practice Zen, we're very familiar with this. Don't get attached to a definitive outcome. So we just basically touched on this a little bit. But in other words, don't goal set. All phenomenon is inherently empty. So here we start getting introduced to the idea of emptiness, which is another teaching that Bodhidharma put forth based on the Lankavatara Sutra. But again, another Dharma talk. All phenomenon is inherently empty with nothing fixed to grab onto. So how can one become fixed on a specific outcome? Bodhidharma said, choose reason, or the sound judgment based on your practice, over whatever is usual in the customs of your culture. So choose reason over custom. And he goes on to tell us that in the sutras, or the teachings of the great masters say that the wise are awakened, fix their minds on the sublime, and let their bodies change with the season. This correlates to the third noble truth, that a way exists to eliminate desire. And then the fourth inclusive gate for entering the path is literally practicing the Dharma. Now here's where it gets a little trickier. So I'm going to do my best to try and unpack this. But that's what conversation is for after the Dharma talk. The truth says that all natures are pure because all phenomenon is empty. The sutras say, or the teachings of the masters say, the Dharma includes no being because it's free from the impurity of being, and the Dharma includes no self because it's free from the impurity of self. Now, this is what I mean by it's starting to get tricky now, because for us as Westerners, when we start throwing in words like pure and impure, a lot of us have bad reactions to that, maybe from some of our old experiences in our lifetime. But my understanding is, when we talk about impurities, we're talking about differentiation of that reality. So we know that different things arise from the flow of reality, because we're existing in that environment. Differentiation. There's walls, there's a carpet, there's David, there's Eve, there's the Buddha statue there. So it's silly to say that everything's the same and we can't differentiate anything. But getting to attach to those differentiations is what I believe he's referring to when he talks about impurity. Basically, don't impede the flow. Don't stop the flow of the underlying essence, because out of that flow, things are created. Things arise that are created in the sphere of our experience. But differentiation and grasping and refusing to believe in the impermanence of that is what's creating these impurities. So that's a lot to wrap our minds around. But I want to give a very simple example to then go on to the next part of his teaching on this. And it might be too simplistic, but I just want us to be able to wrap our minds around this a little bit more. I want to give an example of donating clothes to a charity. So let's say there's a group down the block from your house, you know, according to the grapevine in your neighborhood, they need a donation of clothes. Because you have an open heart and generosity, this really touches you. And being touched by that idea, you're like, okay, I'm going to donate clothes. This feels something very right to me. So let's raise the stakes too. You go to Target or Walmart or wherever you go to shop and you buy brand new clothes, a whole big box full. You're feeling pretty good about this. You go down to the center, you go in, the person who greets you at the door says, hello, welcome. I hear you guys need a donation of clothes, and I brought this whole box for you guys. So I want to leave this with you. And the person at the desk goes, you know what? I really appreciate that. And we do appreciate you coming with this generosity. But, and points to the corner, and there's a mound of clothes from the floor up to the ceiling. We really can no longer use the clothes, and we don't have any space in which to store them anymore. So I can't accept this gift from you right now. But if you're willing to give, we have some people advising the people living here on their next steps. And some of them have children. And we're doing activities for the children right now. Would you be able to assist in maybe doing that? Now, I know for myself, if I'm being realistic about the way I react to things, I would be a little bit frustrated and a little bit upset. And I might have even gotten a little bit angry if they wouldn't take my clothes, because I did a lot of work to get them. But I'm old enough now where I know, and thankfully for my practice, I can acknowledge that. I'm aware of it. And hopefully from my meditation practice, when things arise and I'm fully attentive to them, I can let it go. Now, then I have a couple more options. Now, okay, the situation has changed. I can either help with the kids. Now I'm seeing how I feel. Maybe that doesn't feel right for me to help with the kids. That's okay. I don't have to if it doesn't feel right. I could apologize and go, you know what? I don't really have the time right now. It's okay. I don't need to beat myself up about it. It's not what I intended to do. Walk out with my box of clothes. Maybe I could say, well, you know, there's a Salvation Army a couple blocks away. I'll just leave it there. But this, to me, is an example of practicing with maybe impurities, trying to even out the frustration and maybe getting attached to an outcome and not accepting impermanence and going, okay, I could be aware of this. I could zag when I need to zig and zag. I could still find an outlet for my generosity that feels right for me, not that I'm forcing myself to do. I feel that Bodhidharma was trying to tell us, and I might be making a great leap, that this is practicing the Dharma. He goes on to say that, and since that which is real includes nothing worth begrudging, there's nothing to get mad about. People who awaken and practice the Dharma give their body, life, and property in charity without regret, without the vanity of giver, gift, or recipient, and without bias or attachment. And then he goes on to touch on the paramitas as assists to practicing with this charity being. So these are six virtues that are in our Buddhist practice of generosity, ethics, patience, effort, concentration, wisdom. Again, whole nother Dharma talk there on probably each one of those. But anyway, this last inclusive gate of practice correlates then to the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path is also another list of guidelines on how to live our lives with right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, right concentration, for those that might not be familiar with that. That the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, put forth in some of his first teachings. But now here's the thing I really wanted to look at, because this is the very thing. I've read this teaching throughout the years many times, but this one really stuck out to me this time. As things want to do, like you can look at the same thing again and again, but life is alive and changing, and so is our perspective, and this never really stood out to me as much. But Bodhidharma also proposes to eliminate impurity, those that practice the way teach others. But they teach without becoming attached to form. Thus, through our own practice, they are able to help others. So I want to correlate that. We've been talking a lot, our tantos have been talking a lot here at Ancient Dragon, as we are coming together to practice in person again after the pandemic and all the other things that happened. They've been talking about the different roles people play in the temple, in the Zendo, different jobs that people do to help support our practice. So it occurred to me, this is a very direct and simple way that we're using this suggestion to teach others to enact our practice. Because any role that you have in the Zendo, whether it's ringing bells or being the Kokyo or being the greeter or making offerings, had to be taught to you by somebody else who already was well versed in the practice. And we have a structure to what we do here, like every religion basically does, on how we enacted this practice, how we move around the room, how we bow to our cushions, how we sit down. In order to bring this practice forward, we enact these kind of movements and forms whenever we get together and meet. Now, we believe this is similar to the way that it's been done for thousands of years, but honestly, none of us really know because none of us were there. We do know daily, monthly, as we change our conditions of practice, some of these little details do change. So this is really a koan. How do you bring a traditional practice forward that's been around for thousands of years and has a very set way of doing things, but at the same time, you don't get attached to the outcome of what you're teaching? And really, it just happens in those micro moments from my experience with our practice. So saying, there's a certain way of putting the incense stick in the incensor. And even today when I was making the offerings, I had trouble doing that because I was attached to the way I wanted the stick to be completely upright, seriously. And I was getting frustrated because it kept cocking over to one side. But thankfully, that gift gave me an opportunity to practice the Dharma by going, okay, I'm going to try and straighten it one more time. And if it doesn't straighten completely, I'm just going to let it go. So we could practice actually in these very small ways. So I'm going to stop there and I'm going to open up the floor to discussion. And I hope this has brought up a lot of things for all the people in the room. And I look forward to hearing what you have to say. Thank you, everybody. And thank you, those of you online. It's so nice to see all of you.
Just kind of a stupid question. I just wonder, you know, when they say journey to the West, I mean, isn't it east? I mean, are you going east if you're going to China from India?
Maybe it's a con.
Maybe.
I don't know. Well, they supposedly he went through Indonesia. We have to get a map and kind of, you know.
And then, you know, I mean, there's a book called Journey to the West, right? Was that?
Well, that's a classic in Chinese literature. I want to say, I don't know it well. I just know that it's a classic in Chinese literature. And I think there's a lot of archetypal things that happen in that story. So there might be. And some of you, do you know it at all, David?
That's a monk going from China back to India to bring back many, many sutras.
So it's going the other way.
And it could have been influenced. But again, we don't know for sure if he lived or not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we could say he's an embodiment of a lot of cultural things that maybe were in the flow at that time.
Right. And, I mean, and anyway, what's common is that idea of the journey and going from somewhere and bringing something, and then it changes. His teachings changed, you know, when he got to China.
And that's it too, Eve. Like, I like to look at the commonality in these stories.
Jan's hand is up.
Hi, Jan.
Hi, Aisin. Thank you so much for the talk. And I wanted to say that I was a teacher of math and science. And as a teacher, I really, really emphasized the content of the subject, which I greatly regret now, because I realize that when you're teaching, your emphasis should be on the student and what the student is like, getting to know the student, and hoping that the content of your subject will enhance the life of that student. And I think you've really helped us with that today. And so I want to thank you, or helped me with that today. So I want to thank you.
Thank you, Jan. I mean, you know, I'm also a teacher in martial arts. And any of us that teach for a living, we abut against this all the time. And I think when we're new teachers, we just, you know, we don't know a lot, but we know the discipline we have studied. And so we're trying to imitate what we feel our teachers did for us. But ultimately, you butt up against it. Like, you're trying so hard to teach things a certain way because you're trying to, here's the purity word again, keep pure the tradition or the science you're teaching or whatever the case might be. And you realize you just can't cram stuff down people's throats. And people change with time. They literally change with time. If you're younger, that's hard to realize. But for those of us that are older, we have lived that, and we could say, yeah, that's true. Culturally, and it's important, I think, to try and involve yourself with as many different ages of people as possible, because kids are different. They're not different in the sense they're still kids, and emotionally they still go through the same things humans have across time. But me teaching a physical discipline, physically they're different. What they could do physically at 5 changes every about 7 years. And so I have to change as a teacher in order to teach a physical discipline to them. You know, so I think, and it's not only teachers, I think it's in the forefront for teachers, because you're trying to do this every day, you know, bring a tradition forward or a teaching forward. But in reality, if you think about it, all of us are either teaching or receiving some kind of teaching as we move throughout our life all the time, whether that's at the DMV, at the doctor's office, in the grocery store, when someone tells us where they just changed the tomatoes, you know. So we're really interacting like this all the time. Thanks for that. David Ray?
Oh, thank you for that wonderful Dharma talk. And thank you again for that course that you did on the Eightfold Path. That was soon after I came here. I really appreciated it. I'd like to ask you to say more about goals and not setting goals and goallessness. That just feels front and center for me again, right? I mean, because the Four Noble Truths sound like the structure of a problem and a solution, right? I'm in pain, life hurts. That's some version of I think everybody's story that gets them here and life story. And yet at the same time, we say don't goal set, practice is goalless. Practice is attainment. I know it's an old story, but I'm back on it.
Well, we've been looking at the Avatamsaka. Could someone help me with that?
Avatamsaka Sutra.
The Avatamsaka Sutra a lot. The Flower Ornament Sutra, which is supposedly the Buddha's first teaching after he was awakened. And then my understanding is he taught that. And for those of you who don't know it, it's very psychedelic. It's hundreds of pages. It has everything. It's so meaty and thick, and you could spend a few hundred lifetimes studying it. And there's all kinds of beings in it. It's very vast. So that was his first teaching. But my understanding is nobody got it. Nobody got it. So then, supposedly, and again, this is all our anecdotal teaching, right, on our practice. Then he refined it down to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And that, to me, was skillful means. So in answer to that, realistically, we know that when people come to practice, they are coming with some goal in mind or some relief that they're looking for in mind. And it would be silly not to acknowledge that. And in some ways, it could be hurtful to the person that's in pain coming to practice, trying to alleviate that pain and saying, yeah, but don't goal set. It could actually be hurtful to them because their pain is not being acknowledged. And our practice involves also paying attention in the present moment with what's happening with the person. But then gradually over time, and again, it's skillful means, what does the person need in that moment to help carry them forward in practice? And then over time, ultimately, they're going to be introduced, if they continue their practice, to ideas of emptiness, which maybe as their practice flowers, they can more readily accept. I know, like for me, I came in through the Eightfold Path. I wasn't a meditator. I practiced Buddhism for years before I could meditate. I mean, years, 15, 20 years. I forget how long it was. But even when I heard the Bodhisattva vows that were living to eliminate the suffering of other beings, I was like, what? Because I came to eliminate my own. And I was angry when I heard that because, again, I felt like my own suffering was being discounted. That, and then what brought me to practice is the injustice of my suffering constantly being discounted. Okay, so we have to acknowledge where a person is at. And we have to know when to introduce certain things. And unfortunately, we're not perfect doing that. But that's part of all of our practice to figure that out in relationship to each other, I believe.
Thank you.
I have a lot to say about everything and just go on and on and on.
I think Kirsten's hand is up.
Hello, Kirsten.
Hello, thank you. I was struck by some of the my help while this wonderful Dharma taking place. And I wanted to sort of share my thoughts about what I've gathered so far from your talk. When you brought up at the beginning, you know, Avalokiteshvara and this sort of expression of compassion, and then when you spoke of the teacher-student relationship, I was sort of intrigued to understand the wonderful and intimate connection between those two things. And I jotted down, because I always have to take notes now, I just had a working definition for me in this moment, that compassion with regards to teaching is sort of the capacity of the teacher to wield a fierce yet gentle love enough to let the student explore skillful means. So the teacher who lets the student try and then try again and then fail and work through imitation of the teacher, but then also through evaluation that the teacher might give the student. And then finally, through maybe the extension that the student can bring to the field. And I'm not trying to suggest that those are sequential. I see those arising. And some of this was influenced by the wonderful words that Jan brought. And I believe that the example you gave us of the you going to donate clothes and the recipient being teacher enough to you have to pivot your generosity because we don't need what you have, right? That's kind of amazing. And then the extension might be what would have happened if you gave the clothes to the Salvation Army. That's another sort of teacher-student relationship for a second. And I guess I just wonder, based on what you were saying and anyone else's ideas in the room, does the Dharma also show how constantly vacillating the relationship between the teacher and the student is? And if it does, is that part of it? Is that part of the Dharma? Is it part of its, for lack of a better word, for the work that it does on us, in us, through us? That's all I have.
Well, from my own experience, the longer I practice within that stillness, there is an awful lot of movement. I don't mean anxiety, but I've been becoming very aware of how fluid things are. And I try to remember that when I'm teaching. And I'll just say that, and I'll just kind of pass it off to other people in the room that have more experience than I do in the Dharma, how you guys might answer that question.
When I first started practicing, of course, I thought I was going to achieve something, to escape whatever suffering I was experiencing.
Could she speak louder, please?
Oh, yes, thank you. But these many years later, I find, and I think what I'm wanting to share is this experience to me relates to what your Dharma talk was about, is that there's much less attachment to form or expectation of anything, really. And so to me, that is speaking to don't know mind and the need to be mindful moment by moment. Because really, what I know in this moment might not be what I know the very next moment, because the flow just keeps changing. And so it's, I want to use the word koan, though I don't know if that is really the appropriate word, but to be able to practice a form or have a practice and yet be able to be moment by moment aware that I don't even really know what I'm doing. mm-hmm. or what I'm going to do in the very next moment. But in the end, it's really going to be okay. So that's all I wanted to share.
I can really appreciate that. And I do think, too, that's the key to staying young, if we need to stay young. And keeping an open mind and knowing that we don't know. We don't know. And just being open to accepting what each moment brings can be more difficult the longer we've been alive and we have, we anticipate certain things, but really having that no mind. And not being afraid of what's going to happen next. Like, having the confidence that we can handle whatever is the next thing. Thank you. Asian?
I have a real life example of having to clean up and pack up and dispose of my parents' belongings and home after my dad just passed last month. And it was, you know, we had a set amount of time and we had, you know, some resources, and it really was, but we I had multiple experiences of bringing something like clothes or furniture or books or something someplace and having them, you know, often they were like, yeah, sure, great, thanks. Other times they were like, no, sorry, we don't take that. And, you know, just having to kind of continually, you know, to pivot and change and change my idea, you know, so, you know, and then maybe finding other resources and getting creative and, you know, making gift boxes for family members who couldn't come out and take stuff. Everybody can take one box, right? but so I find that it's a, you know, a kind of a continuous pivot between intention and goal and letting go and stepping back. And so, you know, like the front and back foot in walking, it was something where, you know, we were just continuously off balance, continuously trying something new. And, you know, eventually everything got somewhere, even if it was just to the, you know, large pile of stuff for the trash collectors and it was hard because it was, you know, we just kind of, but you do your best, you know? So it's, I really felt on a very deep level that pivot between just, you know, holding on to something and letting go. And the things that I was, you know, doing at the beginning of the week and, you know, saying to my husband, no, you can't let that go. We're taking that. And, you know, by the end of the week, I was like, oh, okay. And so was everybody else, you know? So I think some of these things are just experience. You have to experience the holding on to where you can't hold on anymore, and then you just let go.
As Aisha was talking, she was doing the classic, no, you can't, give it back, no, you can't. Well, yeah, that's a nod to the classic, like when someone goes, no, we don't take that, the classic, what? Well, what am I going to do with it then? We all know that feeling. And then somehow it works out. Somehow it works out. Oh, my goodness.
Tygen's hand is up.
Hi, Tygen.
Hi, Paula. Thank you for your talk. I just wanted to respond to something Kirsten said. She was asking about the teacher and student, and I think she used the word vacillate or some vacillation or something. And to me, it's more, well, it involves mutuality. So as a teacher, I'm always learning from my students. And part of another way of talking about emptiness is interrelationship. We're all interrelated. You were talking about how we're all one. And what that is that we are related to each other. So, yeah, we learn from each other. And, you know, maybe that's the goal, is just to be open to hearing each other. And so, yeah, there's this mutuality. So that's what I just wanted to say that in response to Kirsten.
Thank you, Tygen.